You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 4th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's program:
the Ukrainians are not running out of courage. They are running out of ammunition. We need to step up now to ensure our support is built to last.
NATO's foreign ministers meet in Brussels on the alliance's 75th anniversary, joined by counterparts from two countries, Ukraine and Finland, that would not have joined just a few years ago. Then we head to Italy to explore why one South Tyrolean region has managed to avoid the country's demographic decline. After that:
it's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
55 years since the world heard that famous grainy line, NASA is preparing for its return to the moon by synchronizing everyone's watches. We'll explain. And finally, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here for part two of a special global countdown that we started last week.
Yes, indeed, Chris. Today we continue our quest to find out the top songs in the world's biggest music markets.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. It is largely because of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine that on today's 75th anniversary of NATO's founding, Finland will be among the countries that is marking the occasion at a summit of foreign ministers in Brussels. Underlining the bond that Finland and Ukraine share was also the visit of Finland's new president, Alexander Stubb, to Kyiv yesterday, where he signed a long-term security pact with Volodymyr Zelensky. Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, will also be on hand in Brussels today, hoping to secure further military aid as Ukraine faces questions about just how much longer its front line can hold off Russian advances. Well, to discuss all of this further, I'm joined now by Charlie Salonius-Pasternak, Senior Research Fellow at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs in Helsinki. And also joining me from Chernivtsi in Ukraine is Olga Tokariuk, a Ukrainian journalist and Academy Fellow at Chatham House. Olga, let's start with you, perhaps. Give us an update on, first of all, some of the attacks that Ukraine faced overnight, particularly in Kharkiv.
Hello, Chris, and thank you for having me. So, yes, again, this night there was a barrage of Russian drones that targeted Kharkiv, a city in eastern Ukraine where more than 1 million people live close to Russian border. We know at the moment about 4 people who have been killed. It was a double tap attack, which means that after the rescuers arrived to the scene of an attack, there was another one. 3 rescue workers have been killed. Among them, there is a 52-year-old man whose son is also a rescue worker who was present in the scene. And there were some moving and heartbreaking videos shared of the son crying because his father has just been killed in this attack. So, but, you know, it is not a one-off. Russia has been targeting Kharkiv really heavily in recent weeks with intense missile and drone attacks. It is very difficult to warn people of an incoming attack because the city is just so close to the Russian border. There is not enough time for people to go to shelter, to take refuge, because the weapons that Russia is launching are arriving there within seconds. And there are fears that Russia might try to attempt another ground offensive to capture Kharkiv. But at the moment, this is not happening. While the aerial attacks, they are very frequent.
Now, Charlie, Finland's new president was in Kyiv yesterday, not that far away from Kharkiv. But what did you make of the visit and what it says, I suppose, about just how much Finland's once neutral stance has changed over the last 2 years?
Well, certainly Finland's foreign security policy has changed drastically. NATO membership is proof, singular proof to that. The visit itself, I think, was meant to underline, and it was, of course, the president and the effectively number two in Finland, the Speaker of Parliament, Jussi Halla-aho, both went there. This agreement, a security pact was signed. And I think the single most important thing is it shows both the breadth of cooperation between Ukraine and Finland and what the two countries want to do, as well as the duration. Just an effort by Finland, not a large country, not the United States or anything else, to say we're in this for the long haul, and we see Ukraine's place in Europe, and together we need to make this happen. So it was partially symbolic, but really these agreements laid the groundwork for years of collaboration and at a deeper and deeper level.
Well, and Olga, as Charlie mentions there, maybe Finland by itself, this is a symbolic move, but it is the eighth member of NATO to seal an agreement like this with Ukraine. What do these security agreements mean for Ukraine in your eyes? How does it sort of compare to, obviously, the eventual goal would be NATO membership itself?
Well, of course, nothing compares with a NATO membership, because if Ukraine becomes a NATO member, it will be under the NATO umbrella, and there will be the commitments under Article 5 would apply to Ukraine as well, which means that if Ukraine is under attack, all the allies have a duty to protect it. So it is not the case. This is not going to happen anytime soon. So this bilateral agreements that Ukraine keeps signing with various countries in the interim are seen as a temporary measure to provide reassurance to Ukraine, to provide on a bilateral basis some sort of assurances, to secure some long-term military support to Ukraine on behalf of these countries, but also an exchange of experience and of approaches between Ukraine and these countries that could also be beneficial for them, not just for Ukraine.
And Charlie, I wonder if you could also describe a little bit how Finland plays into NATO's 75th anniversary and the summit today. I wonder where they stand on some of the discussions that are happening about among foreign ministers about what Ukraine needs right now.
Well, Finland, I just wanted to jump in and agree completely with Olga in terms of the idea that this is not just one side giving and receiving. It is Finland, Ukraine, both benefiting in different ways. And as a bridge to what is NATO doing, I think the 23rd weapons assistance package from Finland to Ukraine was also announced yesterday. And Finland tends to do it low-key, not talk about it, and rather deliver the very specific things that Ukraine has asked for in terms of artillery, ammunition, or things like that. And this, I think, in Finland is also seen as it's much easier to now go and, yes, celebrate 75 years. But as we've heard the Finnish foreign minister say, it is nice, of course, to celebrate, but there's serious business to be done. And Finland being able to say, look, we have given a significant proportion of GDP and our defense material already. Kind of what are you other allies doing? Because Finland's a frontline state. So certainly Finland is in the group pushing for NATO collectively to do more, Ukraine, deterrence against Russia, let's see if the bigger European countries catch up on this.
And Olga, I mean, Kuleba, the foreign minister, is also in Brussels and is expected to ask for more Patriot air defense systems in particular. I wonder what your sense is of what he's likely to get. Charlie was outlining there that Finland is one of those countries pressuring, but the question, of course, is whether others will agree to this.
Well, I think what Foreign Minister Kuleba is trying to do in Brussels today is to convey the sense of urgency that is around, Ukraine's situation with the shortage of ammunition, which includes the Patriot missile defense systems. Of course, this is a closed information. We have no idea how many of them Ukraine still has. But Russian attacks on Ukrainian cities are still going on. Just in recent weeks, there were multiple attacks again on energy infrastructure objects in various parts of Ukraine. Kharkiv, which we mentioned earlier today, has been without electricity for a long time. And now, Russia keeps attacking it. And as I said, around a million of people still live there. So it is really crucial for Ukraine to be able to protect its skies, to protect its civilian population, to protect its energy infrastructure, to protect other types of infrastructure. And as the aid to Ukraine is still being delayed in the US Congress, we see there is no progress on the aid package yet. I think the issue of especially keeping the Ukrainian sky protected is becoming really crucial alongside with helping Ukrainian defenders on the front line to hold the line against Russian attacks.
Charlie, what Olga brings up there, the U.S. funding, and I was curious from that perspective as well, what Finland thinks, I suppose, whether Europe needs to kind of stand up for its own defense here, and is that something that Finland will be pushing more now that it is in NATO as well and at this meeting?
Absolutely. You've heard it from every Finnish official that irrespective of who wins in the U.S. presidential elections, Europe has to develop its ability to defend itself. And I think Finland, being one of the few countries that maintain this ability, has a pretty good case to make as a frontline state, saying this is what we do in totality, very much like Ukraine, a total defense effort. And I'd like to add just one thing to kind of a Finnish perspective. It's one thing to say we should do more, we should give more weapons, but why? And here I think we heard the Finnish president, Alex Stubb, yesterday say something quite unique for a Finn, again, considering how the security policy environment dimension has changed. He said, Finland's not giving military aid to Ukraine just to give some assistance. Finland's giving it to Ukraine so Ukraine can win. That's the goal from a Finnish official point of view.
Charlie Salonius Pasternak and Olga Tokariuk, thank you very much for joining us. Now here's Carlotta Ribello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. The founder of World Central Kitchen, Jose Andres, has accused Israel of targeting the charity's workers systematically, car by car. The celebrity chef was referring to the deaths of seven World Central Kitchen staffers who were killed by Israeli missiles on Monday. Andres said Israeli forces knew of the workers' movements and that it was not just bad luck. Rescuers are working to free more than 600 people stranded in eastern Taiwan after an earthquake struck the island on Wednesday. The 7.4 magnitude earthquake was the strongest to hit Taiwan in 25 years. At least 9 people were killed. Voters in Kuwait will head to the polls today for the country's parliamentary election, the latest round of voting after years of political turmoil. The oil-rich country's emir, Sheikh Mishal, dissolved parliament in February after a lawmaker reportedly insulted the ruler. And French President Emmanuel Macron is expected to unveil the new sporting venue today. The Paris Aquatic Centres will be used during the Olympic Games to host water polo, diving and synchronized swimming competitions. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Carlotta. Now, in the battle among Western nations to raise their birth rates and avoid a demographic decline in the next few decades, Italy is among those facing the biggest challenge. But there is one place in the country that's bucking the trend, and that's Bolzano in South Tyrol. It's one of the few regions where the birth rate has actually held steady over the last few decades, thanks in part to the family-friendly policies of the regional government. That makes it a place for Italians and other countries to study for lessons they might be able to bring back home. Want to tell us more? I'm joined by Jason Horowitz, Rome Bureau Chief of the New York Times. Jason, thanks so much for coming on the show. Set the stage for us, if you will, to begin with. This demographic problem for Italy has been highlighted by everyone from the Pope to the Prime Minister.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for having me, first off. Italy is facing, you know, one of the most acute birth rate problems in the Western world. It's about 1.2 now, their birth rate. And coupled with an increasingly elderly population, that spells a sort of demographic disaster for Italy in the next 50 years. The obvious repercussions are if you have an older, increasingly older population and less people to work, you're going to have less resources for pensions, for health, for all sorts of things. So it's a major problem for the country. And also it's something existential as well. The Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, feels this very deeply. She's talked about the worry of Italy disappearing. Pope Francis has echoed that. And even outsiders who seem to love Italy very much, like Elon Musk, can't stop talking about the idea that Italy might disappear.
Now, Jason, you visited Bolzano to get a sense of what was happening there. I wondered, first of all, how you heard about this in the first place. I mean, were you kind of trawling through the data and finding out that Bolzano was this unique place? Or is it a place that's also highlighted among Italians themselves?
Well, it's actually, so this is an issue I've been paying attention to for quite a bit of time. And I went to a conference about a year ago with Pope Francis and with Prime Minister Meloni, and they appeared together on stage, and the Pope joked that they were both wearing white. But what was funny about it was that they were highlighting an issue that used to be somewhat divisive in Italy. So the idea that of boosting the birth rate was often considered a old, almost fascist idea, right? The idea that you had to increase Italy's population for identity, for its power, for its sort of glory. So Mussolini did this. And so after Mussolini, there was a stigma around the idea of boosting the birth rate. And that, and the left often thought that that was very problematic and didn't want to talk about it. But now the problem has become so severe that it's sort of across the political spectrum. It's recognized as a real major challenge for the country. So while I was there, one of the leading statisticians in the country was there as well. And I started talking to him, and he mentioned all the problems. But he said something which intrigued me, which was like, the only place that seems to be holding steady is Bolzano, which is in the extreme northeast of the country, in Alto Adige or South Tyrol. And I just wanted to know why.
And so tell us a little more then about why. I mean, one of the interesting things about what you write about it is there is a mix. It's one side of this is what the regional government in particular is doing differently than Italy as a whole. But there is also a cultural element to this as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. So first off, I think that policy actually does matter on this. And so one of the problems that Italy has encountered is because this was sort of a politically loaded issue, and because Italy has a problem with stability in its governments, long-term planning hasn't been terrific on this. And whereas other countries, for example, France, has made long-term sort of policies that help families with small children by providing childcare and things like that, Italy has not. And also the other major policy issue is that it's now pretty much accepted that in order to boost the birth rate, it's important that women work so that they can plan, so that they can have agency. And that's a little counterintuitive from the way the church used to look at it and the far right used to look at it. But now everyone pretty much accepts that women need to be working. So the policies up in Bolzano do that. They are very sort of generous. There's lots of financial help. There's lots of daycare. There's lots of just incentives, even discounts at the supermarket, on transportation, on all sorts of things that make it easier to have children. And so policy should not be forgotten. That said, there's also a cultural element here, which is that Bolzano is in a part of the country that hasn't always been Italy. It was Austria for a long time, and it goes sort of ping-pongs back and forth depending on the war and who's up and who's down. And so being on a border, there's a stronger sense of identity. There, the language is different there. Besides the fact that most people around Bolzano speak German, there's another Ladino. It's called a smaller language that people feel very possessive of. So it's the idea of preserving identity. And to preserve identity, one thing that's crucial is that you need a next generation.
So it's interesting as you describe those two aspects, the culture and the policies. So just finally on this then, if it is the policies in part, I just wonder how much you feel those are things that can be expanded. It's just also particularly interesting that this is a regional government that is doing this rather than a national government.
Right. So, and it's a regional government that because of the sort of nuances of Italian history has a lot of autonomy. So it can do a lot more than other regions in providing financial incentives and making its own laws. And it's decided to really push on family-friendly policies. But I do think that if those sort of family-friendly policies were distributed evenly throughout the entire country, and most importantly, if it was made easier for women to work by providing childcare throughout the country, reliable, inexpensive childcare, you know, most experts believe, and you know, including the Italian government, believe that it would really help in making it possible for Italians who want to have more children, according to experts, it would make it easier for them to have those children. The problem often with Italy, though, is that is in the doing, and actually sort of staying in power long enough, planning, you know, long term, putting the money and actually spending the money, which is often a difficulty in Italy, even when it's earmarked, is a challenge. So Italy's challenge, I feel now, is not so much in how do you raise the birth rate, but in actually making it happen.
Jason Horowitz, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. Now, if you're still struggling to figure out which time zone you're in, given that the clocks have now sprung forward in the US and Europe, but not in Australia, then you'll probably be throwing up your hands at the news that the moon will get its own time zone as well. Coordinated Lunar Time, CLT, is to be developed by the US space agency NASA by 2026 in the hopes that it will become the new international norm. Because multiple time zones in space would surely just confuse things. Joining me now from Brussels is Joshua Posner, senior defense and space reporter at Politico. Joshua, thanks very much for coming on to explain this to us. Let's start with the fact that NASA was instructed to do this by the White House. Why is the White House involved?
Hey, Chris. So, yeah, there's two big explanations here. I think there's the very practical ground level situation that it's going to be very useful to synchronize spacecraft. And of course, the US is running the Artemis program. It wants to get astronauts back on the moon by 2027 at the latest, hopefully 2026. So there's that very practical aspect of offering some kind of very precise time synchronization to do that. And there's also the bigger picture, which is preparing the ground with infrastructure standards protocols for a sustained permanent presence on the lunar surface, which is what the US wants. It's also what China and Russia are working towards too.
Now, as you mentioned there, China and Russia as well, plenty of countries are looking at the moon at the moment. It's getting increasingly crowded. How much will this help that sort of coordination between countries?
I mean, as you said in the introduction, I think it's very important to have agreement on what time it is. And so this is the kind of standard that will be very necessary for the US to work with allies to develop out common agreements over what to recognize, whose standards to adhere to, as we do with time on Earth. It's as yet quite unclear how that's going to work in practice. I know many of your listeners will be more than aware that there are two big blocks emerging. There's the Artemis Accords. This is the US's own preferred rule book for space and what to do on the moon. And then there's the China standards, which has roped in Russia, Pakistan, South Africa, Belarus too, and they're trying to build an international lunar research station with a set of standards there too.
So that's the big picture in terms of what's being built on the moon. How much does this sort of fight over a time zone play into that? I mean, what are the odds that if NASA develops a time zone, other nations, this other bloc will follow?
I would say at this moment in time, it's very unlikely that they would follow. I think there's a significant amount of research being done all over the world. So this obviously has made a lot of news over the last 24 hours because it's the US and because it's NASA, and obviously a lot of funding and geopolitics comes with that. The European Space Agency has been working for a long time on this kind of work too, trying to figure out how to measure time on the lunar surface. I would bet you that China and Russia, scientists and engineers and think tankers there, have been working on this issue too. This is just one part of this overall strategy to start creating systems, infrastructure for the permanent presence on the moon. Of course, we're having the debate today about the time zone, but it was also the case that a couple of weeks ago, Northrop, a major US defense contractor, was given a feasibility study contract by the US to start looking at a lunar railroad, which would theoretically be able to, in the decades ahead, start shifting around raw materials and linking up potentially moon bases or launch sites on the lunar surface too. So the time zone is very important, but it's just one part of a far broader story emerging.
Lunar railroad crops potentially being grown on the moon as well. I mean, there are so many of these aspects to it. And that, I guess, kind of brings us back to the White House being involved. I just wonder if you could describe how much of a prestige it really is to have NASA considering a return to the moon for the United States.
It's a huge prestige, and I think this is often described as a space race. And I know many experts and think tankers get a bit annoyed at this because it's not really a race anymore. It's very different to what we experienced in the Cold War. Everybody is going there. It doesn't really matter so much who gets there first. The Americans would very much like that to be the case with the Artemis 3 mission in 2-3 years' time. But actually, China, Russia, the US, even the Europeans are all planning missions, projects around the lunar surface now. And what was very striking to me is how public this has been this week. And it's not just about the science and the creation of these standards for the lunar time zone. It's also about sending the message that this is a priority for the White House.
It's all geopolitics in the end. Joshua Posner, thanks very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Finally, on today's show, our senior correspondent and musical curator, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is back in the studio for our weekly global countdown. Faye, it's a special one this week, part two. We did this last week. It is looking at global sales of music. We did 1 to 5 last week.
And now we're doing 6 to 10, or, as because it's a global countdown, 10 to 6.
Fair enough.
It's interesting because, of course, the top five music markets, I mean, there's no surprise there. There's the US, we have China, we have Japan. But I think it's interesting to see between who is number 6, who is number 7, who is number 8, 9, and 10.
6 to 10 are a little more eclectic, I think it's fair to say.
I think so as well. But you did mention the word eclectic. I'm really sorry, Chris. We're going to start at number 10 with Australia. The reason I'm saying sorry, because guess who is number 1 in Australia?
Okay, do tell.
I think you might have an idea, because this guy's everywhere. This 21-year-old from Monroe in Washington, he's a small-town guy. He's a Mormon as well. Let's have a listen. It's Benson Boone with Beautiful Things.
Please stay. I want you, I need you, oh God. Don't take these beautiful things that I've got. Please stay. I want you, I need you, oh God. Don't take these beautiful things that I've got.
This is the second time we have played Benson Boone in 2 weeks. We could have played him 3 times. We fudged it last week.
Yeah, I mean, we have to fudge it. I mean, but he is everywhere. He seems to be a friendly guy. He likes the outdoors. I mean, he dances very well, even though his music's not quite dance friendly. But, you know, he's a good dancer too.
A rock dancer.
Exactly, exactly. Well, that's number 10 for you. But don't worry, we have something different now.
We're going more eclectic now. Well, we're going to your home country, Fernando, which is always eclectic.
And, you know, Chris, first of all, I have to mention, in Brazil, is very rare, almost unheard of, to have a song that is not from a Brazilian artist, and number one. I think the Brazilian market is similar to Japan, perhaps, that
yes,
we discussed last.
It was all dominated by Japanese. What it evolved, we were talking about.
Exactly. And this song is not sunny at all, actually. It talks about how money can corrupt you. And even the video for that song was filmed in Rocinha, the biggest favela in Rio. But they decided to film not on a sunny day. So they chose a very cloudy day. So it doesn't have that sunny Brazilian vibe.
Gloomy. It's gloomy.
But it is some, you know, some cool Brazilian hip hop there. This is TZ do Coronel with Qual é seu desejo? What's your desire?
Fala comigo, vai tia, qual é seu desejo? Já vi essa cena na vida e nem foi déjà vu. Tem esse cash no bolso. O que seria do dia azul?
Is this going to be making our musical playlist, Faye?
No. No, it will not. It is very gloomy.
And it was very honest of you.
And Chris, I got to be honest, I didn't know TZ do Coronel, but he has got so many millions and millions of followers in Brazil. And I found out he was in London last week for the Trap Festival, showcasing some of this new Brazilian artist, you know, hip-hop and trap artists.
I wonder if he was joining the Finnish trap that you did a few weeks ago on this show.
Exactly. I mean, it's a big genre. I really need to catch up and get down with the kids, you know?
That's it. It's all about getting down with the kids.
Always.
Let's move on to number 8. We are heading across, well, north of Brazil, I suppose, to Canada.
To Canada. Again, not a Canadian artist, but funnily enough, this track is a diss against a Canadian artist, which is Drake. But it's not, the song's not about Drake. It's the rapper's Future and Metro Boomin as well, with the rap legend Kendrick Lamar. I do like Kendrick Lamar quite a lot. The song's called Like That. And I didn't quite understand, but apparently Kendrick Lamar has some beef with Drake. And there's some verses in this track where you can kind of recognize that. And you
so
know
it
what?
It is about Drake, but it's not about Drake. But it is about Drake.
Exactly. Please, if a listener knows more about this fight, let me know. But you know what? In this fight, I stick with Kendrick Lamar. Not a big fan of Drake here. Let's have a listen.
Hey, let's get it, bro. D.O.T., the money, power, respect.
The last one is better.
Say it's a lot of goofies with a check.
I mean, I hold them sentiments symbolic. My temperament bipolar, I choose violence.
Okay, let's get it up. It's time for him to prove that he's a problem. Niggas clicking up, but can not be legit. No 40 water, tell him. Get up with me. Fuck sneak.
This one does have our producer, Steph, dancing the most.
I like the beat, I have to say. And, you know, I'm not sorry at all for Drake. Sorry for all the Drake fans listening to us in the moment. I'm sure Drake is a very nice guy as well.
And listeners, do please fill us in on what's going on between Kendrick Lamar and Drake.
Yeah, if I find out the real reasons, maybe I can change my point of view here, you know?
Tell us next week.
Exactly.
Moving on to number 7, another one that, I don't know, is maybe surprising that it would be so large, number 7 in the world, but I guess not really because of the export market, South Korea.
I mean, they're a country that is known for their music. And again, not just in South Korea, right? K-pop is everywhere. I mean, it is established genre now. And this band that we're going to play, it's the number one song there, is G-IDLE. They achieved something that is called the perfect all-kill, or PAK. So basically, very few artists got that. Basically, you reach the top slot in all the local charts in South Korea, in all the streaming services. It's very rare. They managed. It's the girl band G-IDLE with Fate.
카페인으로 잡은 정신은 빠지고 하루 종일 신경 쓰여 토할 것 같아 저녁 이대도 배고프까지 까먹고 그치 이상하지 근데 말이야 있잖아
처음 본 순간 뭘 알까 그랬다가 나도 웃긴데 말야 영원했던 하늘이 무너지고 어둡던 눈알이 붉어지며
I do wonder if there's a difference between K-pop that makes it in South Korea and K-pop that makes it outside of South Korea.
Well, I'm not too sure, but all I can say is that G-IDLE is quite popular outside South Korea. So maybe in that sense, there's a crossover there. And it's interesting about the name. You know, they were going to name the band IDLE, but then IDLE, I-D-L-E, in South Korean means child or children. And then in English,
what does G-IDLE mean?
so then an idol in English, of course, is someone that doesn't really like to work that much.
Yeah.
So they said, you know what, let's stick a G there.
I mean, let's just add a G.
Let's add a G. That's what you should do, you know, if you're unsure about the name of your band.
Well, we'll see if that one makes the chart somewhere else, number one in a future week, perhaps. Let's move on to the final one, the number one being the number 6 in the music markets for this week.
And Chris, I'm a very honest person. I had to cheat a little bit here as well. Because
Benson
Boone. Even the French are putting Benson Boone at number
yes,
one.
Yes, this is France,
but
we
that,
should say.
It's France, of course. But that gave me a very good excuse to look at their albums chart. And there's a very interesting story this week. Because the number one album in France is L'Enfoiré, which means The Bastard. 2024, and they're celebrating 35 years. That's a tradition in France. So basically, L'Enfoiré is a group of artists, it changes every year, that they sing every year to support a charity called Restaurant du Corps. So basically, this charity distributes, you know, food packages and hot meals for the ones they need the most in society. But it's a tradition, so people in France love it, and of course, people are buying the special CD. And we're going to play the main single from that album is L'Enfoiré, which is, you know, a huge amount of French artists there, with Jusque un dernier, with Until the Last One.
It is very anthem-y, I suppose, is the word.
You know, helping for a good cause as well. And it's interesting, this year I think there's 47 artists involved. But the one...
In one song?
In one album, the whole album. That's just one of the singles. But we have to give credit to Patrick Bruel. He's been part of this charity 32 times since 1989, including this year. So he's actually the top artist in terms of the number of times that he's been... part of this kind of great event in France.
I do have to also ask you just quickly, how much was there a mix of French and non-French music in France? It's always particularly interesting, I think.
I think in France you have some foreign songs as well, but it's still very much a French market. I think like South Korea and Brazil, it is very, very French. Unlike a place like Australia, which is kind of almost rare to see an Australian artist. You have some, but they're more kind of open to other artists.
Open to others. The French do always fight for their language and their music. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. And that is all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Emma Searle. Our researcher was George Ruskin. And our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye. And thanks for listening.